a podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello and welcome to episode 42 of If This Is a Podcast Then What's Christmas. It might end up being episode 43, so try and cope with that if you can. I'm sure you'll manage. It's my chat with Ben Priest. So I've explained a bit about this in the blog, but I emailed Ben and asked him if he would do an episode of the podcast. I thought he'd be one of the most useful people to speak to because he is the overall creative director. I don't know if he's the ECD or the CCO or maybe even the chairman these days of Adam and Eve DDB, which is clearly, if not the best agency in the world, one of them, 7 Cannes Grand Prix in 3 years, et cetera, et cetera. Many, many fantastic ads. So I thought he'd be great. And initially he turned me down saying he'd already done a podcast or two or done a few of them and didn't want to repeat himself. And so I asked him about doing a startup one for my little startup series. And he then said yes. And there is a bit of similar ground covered between my chat with him and Dave's. Dave's is longer by a good about maybe 40 minutes. So there was going to be some crossover. But I would urge you, if you've listened to Dave's and you think it's going to be the same stuff, to listen to this one because some of the stuff will be kind of similar. You know, Ben's beginning as an account person, how Adam and Eve, the name arrived, things like that. We cover that too. If you want, you can compare the consistency of Ben's stories if that interests you. But also, you know, why not listen to it twice? Because, you know, how often do you get a chance to hear firsthand the advice of someone who has succeeded to such an enormous degree in this business? I'd also really like to point out how damn nice Ben is. Obviously, most of the people you've heard on this thing are nice too, so it's not an unusual trait, I'm glad to say, in human beings. But Ben's email replies were really quick, and he was obviously incredibly magnanimous to give his time. And, you know, I don't know exactly who you are listening to this right now, where you sit on the ad agency ladder, or if you're just passing the time and you're not in the business. But you kind of think that the guy running the creative department, the best creative department in the world, might be, I don't know, maybe a little bit more into himself. I'm trying to think of a nice word, up his own ass. But Ben is the exact opposite. He's not anywhere near his own ass, which is great. And I think this comes out, this won't be in the chat because I cut it out from the beginning, but we had to wait about 5 or 10 minutes at the start because Ben was trying to get into his own conference room. And rather than go, you do know I'm like the head of this agency, he just waited for the meeting to finish and we got on with it after that. So nice, humble, if that's the right word, and, you know, full of incredible advice. So have a listen. Thanks very much for making the time to chat, Ben. It's very kind of you.
Not at all. Thank you for asking me.
Great. So I know you said you've done a couple of these podcasts before, but I think it might be really good to, because you've got a very unique beginning as far as I'm aware. I don't know too many people who've risen to your height as a creative and yet started as an account person. Can you just give us a bit of background on that? Because I think it's pretty unusual.
Yeah, or Robert Savile, although I believe is another example. So he did all right for himself. But yeah, I basically my dad was a client. So as a kid growing up, and he was a good client actually. So he was at Volkswagen and at Mazda, and he always pursued the DDBs or the GGTs, whatever he felt were the creatively rich and kind of determined agencies of the day. So growing up, I very quickly worked out that all the most fun sort of mad people that came to our house all worked in advertising. And then my dad said, you know those funny things in between the TV programs that you love, that's what they do. And so my interest was very, you know, it really caught my attention. And but I'd been to university for 3 years to read English, and I applied for a place at Watford to do copywriting, and Tony offered me a place. But my dad said, don't be a prat. You've been at college for 3 years. Go and get a job. Just get a job in an agency. And in those days, I still listened to what my dad said and presumed that he was correct. So I, at the same time as Watford, I went for account management interviews. And the first one I went to was at Ogilvy, and Scylla Snoble, who runs AMV now, was in charge, and she offered me a job. So I turned Watford down and went into account management. And it was an amazing, I mean, the Ogilvy thing was kind of, if you look around London now, most people running agencies, or many of them, went through that graduate scheme. A brilliant collection of people, Johnny Hornby, and funny enough, James Murphy, Charlie Rudd, all sorts of folks. So off I went, and in the long run, it was very good, but I hated it. I hated it almost immediately. It didn't feel like it was anything to do with the work. We were doing all the other bits of the job. And so after a week, I tried to quit, and they said no. You know, we spent a lot of money putting this course together, interviewing you guys, recruiting you, get on and do it. And so I did it for a year and a bit, and I was terrible at it, and I didn't like it. But it was an invaluable experience, I have to say. I mean, and I got to hang out on the creative floor, and there were people like Clive and Jerry there who'd been at GGT and knew what they were doing, and so I listened to them very carefully, and I wrote a load of terrible ads that people very kindly looked at. But more than that, really, it was just seeing clients, seeing their side of life, seeing big meetings, seeing how work was presented or presented quite poorly, or being amazed that there were never any creative people there, that kind of stuff. So eventually I quit and went on the dole and put a book together and began that process. And bizarrely, 6 months later, via Simon's Palmer, ended up back at Ogilvy, but this time on the creative floor. I felt it was a big waste of time at the time, but actually I think it was very important.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for maybe more creatives having a little bit more of a background of what goes on in an agency, rather than being a little bit more cosseted in this world of, hey, we're just writing ads, but realizing there's more to it might be quite useful for people.
Yeah, funnily enough, I think that is very true. If you can keep creative people, you know, they're going to be creative, they're going to be curious. But I think the worst thing you can do is almost let them live in a sort of a strange, isolated island within the agency. It's much we don't have creatives that sit on a creative floor in a creative space. They sit in amongst account people, planners, production, all dotted about across the two floors of the agency. And so they see account people busting their guts every day. They hear clients' worries and concerns. And so they live in the real world, and they understand the business and the round. And it doesn't make them less creative. It makes them more creative. And you get lots and lots of lovely, happy accidents where people go, hey, I heard you talking about this. We nearly did that, but we did it. What about this? And can I show you this bit and that? So there's a kind of sharing that comes with it. But I think those isolated creative departments are not good. They basically end up writing work to impress each other, which normally impresses no one in the real world.
Right. And a lot of your earlier really good work was done with Brian Campbell. Did you team up straight away, or was a bit of time before that happened?
No, I had a great partner starting out, a chap called David Harvey, who unfortunately, after we'd been working together for sort of about a year and a half, became ill and subsequently very seriously ill and died, which was absolutely terrible. You know, he was a very talented young man. And after that, I was at CDP working with a guy called Tim Brooks. And Kevin Thomas was very important in my career. So he was an art director at Low Howard Spink. And he phoned me up and said, look, I know you and your partner came to show me your book, but actually I'd like to talk to you about coming over on your own. We have a chap here called Brian Campbell who's on his own. And so I went over, and that was the promised land for me. You know, Low Howard Spink in those days was a seriously good agency, packed with very, very good crazy people and a sort of account list that you would dream of, the Heinekens, Stellas, Olympus, Reebok, lots of big Weetabix, lots of big famous campaigns that won awards and people loved. And so Brian and I were sort of speed dated together like that. Yeah, and we had, I think, 8 or 9 years, which was absolutely great. And I did my best work with Brian and loved working with him. But we eventually ended up going, as happens quite a lot, people began to call about, do you want to come make the move up to creative director? And then you it's very sad, actually. You end up on your own a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And you've existed in a world where you've always had your work buddy there, and you can say, is this idea terrible? You know, is this headline not as good as I think it is? Is this end joke awful? Do you really think we should be sending this to Tony Kaye? You know, that lovely security you get in, you can check whether you're going down a blind alley, and it's important to go down them, but you always have someone to pull you back. And so suddenly you life changes and you're on your own, and you're alone with your thoughts, and you give advice and disagree with people and make difficult decisions, but you don't have anyone to turn to. And I remember really feeling that, actually, the first year of Greater Direction. It felt very lonely compared to the lovely security you have when you're in a good team and you work well together.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I just go back a tiny bit? Because,
yeah, sorry.
No, that's cool. I was just... because I've interviewed Mark Denton a few times and chatted to him, the first work I'm aware of that you got in DNAD was when you were at Simons Palmer. And that is a department that if Ogilvy provided all the agency leaders when you started off, Simons Palmer provided all the creative leaders, I guess, probably when you were there or not long after. What was that like as a very junior person?
I mean, it makes me very sad, actually, because it's an agency. It's not a forgotten agency. But for me, it was so important. I was there for 1 week. Wow. 1 week only. You know, they got David and I in and said, we want you to do Wrangler posters. Sit in that room. Don't nick anything. And when we just worked. And it was, they'd done this piece of research that one of the things that people, was a barrier to people buying Wrangler jeans was the big stitch W on the back. And so Chris and Mark being geniuses had said, well, let's make loads of fun W's. Let's run towards this problem. And our posters will just be W's. And we haven't got any money, and the client probably doesn't want any. So we need to come up with ones that we can illustrate, photograph with mates for free and make. So we just sat in a room for a week and did W's. But there was only Chris and Mark there and Tim Riley and Andy Mackay next door. But it was just magic. It was, you know, they just shot with Vaughan and Antia the... you know, the pirate DJ.
Yeah.
So the whole building echoed to smoother than the cream in a Twinkie word up. And it was a phrase we never forgot. And they gave lovely Nike work, Terence Higgins Trust. They just won a huge chunk of BT, which really scared the crap out of everyone, because suddenly this little creative startup was beginning to pull in proper, you know, proper brands, proper proper budgets. And it was amazing. You know, Chris and Mark are... they were just the most fabulous combination, and it was just an agency at the absolute top of its game, and it could do anything. And once you'd been there and you'd seen that, you knew where the bar was and you knew where you wanted to get to. So I loved it. We worked away for a week. We plastered the walls with posters. Chris and Mark threw us out at 10 o'clock every night when they left. And then we disappeared to Ogilvy and did a placement, got offered a job. And then 6 months later, someone rang us and said, oh, we've made that Wrangler poster of yours. It's going to be in Private View tomorrow.
Wow.
And one of the Delaney's, not Tim, one of the other ones, sort of basically wrote, this is the biggest piece of shit I've ever seen in my life, which we took as a huge compliment after we looked up what his agency did. And then we got a call 2 months later saying, oh, it's got in the book. Yeah, so that's how good Simons Palmer was, the first ad you ever did. I mean, they were very clever in that they kept us completely away from the production of it, because we'd have fucked it up royally. And Andy Mackay and Malcolm Benbow produced it. Sort of these huge, enormous, great laminates arrived a few days later. And I'll show you how old I am. We had to go out and have a portfolio handmade, so it was large enough to fit the Simons laminate. Everything else was tiny by comparison, but it was just it was great, you know. And they could do everything. They did funny, they did silly, they could do really trendy, they could do it was a time when they were doing Kick It, really, really lovely Wrangler work. They kind of created modern posters, I think. The art direction on those Nike ads, if you look at them with Andy Mackay and Mark kind of at the helm, it set the standard for just how provocative and beautifully put together outdoor could be. So I loved it, and I'm an enormous Chris and Mark all my career, I've always been able to ring one of them up or both of them up when they were together and come and show them the embarrassments of my portfolio, and they'd sit with you for hours and encourage you and tell you what was shit. And I'm a massive fan of them, and I hope that they're remembered. They've both gone on to be incredible directors, but I remember them as equally incredible creative directors.
Absolutely. So just skipping back forward to Lowe, then, just to try to be a bit kind of evocative of the time, I went to Watford 95, 96. So the first D&AD I was properly aware of was 96, which contains your Olympus print campaign. And it's a really remarkable campaign. It's really fantastic. And I love the fact that D&AD in those days would print your ad multiple times if it got in multiple times, rather than just put it once and go, it got in for these things. And it felt like the more times it was in, the more times it got imprinted on your mind. And to me, that was like, this is this sort of peak of stuff. And I don't know if you recall, but my partner and I at the time actually came to see you and Brian at Lowe.
Oh, God.
I'm going to assume you don't remember that. But
I hate it when people say this. Yeah.
Well, nothing
and
weird.
You hit both of us and threw our portfolio out the window. Oh.
Well, that was it. Nothing weird happened. It was a perfectly normal crit, and I don't, you know, there wasn't like a job at the end of it or anything like that. But you know, you look through the stuff. But I remember thinking, this is so amazing. We're getting to see this team that did this incredible Olympus campaign, and because that, I guess, is relatively early in your career, and I believe it won 3 pencils. Could you give us an idea of how that came about, and also what it was like to be the guys who won the 3 pencils that early on in your career?
It was a brilliant experience. We went over to Lowe Hadspink, and we were quite junior, and so we weren't really allowed to play on TV. So we realised very quickly that print and poster was our opportunity, and they'd got Steve Dunover, who'd been Tim Delaney's partner and head of art, and Steve's responsibility was exactly that, print and poster. So it was one of those lovely things. I always think the best experience is when there's a few of you involved. So basically, Brian and I will work like kind of galley slaves writing headlines once we got this idea. And we had the idea for this contact sheet art direction, that this camera was so expensive for Olympus, that it was going to be people who were really serious, who loved the smell of film, the sight of film, the touch of it, and all of that sort of stuff. And Steve just worked you into the ground. So we just wrote, and he would look at hundreds and hundreds, good, not great, keep going, that's what you get, and then you'd go back. And we got the fabulous Adam Whittaker helped us with the art direction. And actually, Paul Weinberger was great, because I'd written a very long, clunky version of the end line. And one of the things Paul was brilliant at is you'd have it all there. And then he'd say, well, shouldn't it be, you know, Fanatics Only, please? And boom, there it was, and you grab it. So, and we had Ian Dickens as well. I mean, you can't do anything like that without a great client. And Ian Dickens at Olympus was one of the greatest clients. And he backed the whole thing. He wanted to do something different. He wanted to break away from their normal art direction look. It was a very different camera for them. It was way more expensive. So it was a dream, really. And we just loved doing it. We were able to, because it was about photography, you could photograph anything. So we wrote to all these our dream photographers and said, if we gave you the camera and this much film, what would be the project you'd choose to photograph? And they all wrote back in with their suggestions. And then we picked, you know, whether it was cowboys or the seagulls of St. Ives or whatever, we just picked these different topics, and we didn't go on the shoot or anything, and away they went. So everyone, you just had, as you should do, you had sort of like 6 or 7 different groups of people all contributing beautifully and being given the freedom to really go for it. And it just came together. It came together really well. And I think Tom Carty was on the print jury, and Brian was as well. And Brian's a very lovely man, but not the most vocal. And I think he sat there very quietly and didn't say anything. And Tom Carty sort of ranted and lapel tapped everybody and said, it's got to be this, it's a step forward, blah, blah, blah. And then, so we got 3 pencils out of it. And I think on the way out, Tom Carty said, that was great. And Brian sort of finally said, yes, yeah, I did that. And he was like, really? Oh. So it was great. It was great for us. And it was our first year working together. So yeah, really lovely experience.
And how long were you at Lowe until you moved to, was it Simons Palmer next, or TBWA, pardon me?
No, no. T- TBW, yeah, I think it was actually at the time called GGT, TBW, no, TBWA, GGT, Simon Spark, you know, so yeah. No one had wanted to give their name up. So they had the whole shooting match. The sign, you know, reception was 22 foot long. But it was about three, I think we did sort of 3.5 years at Low, and then we did 3.5 years at 3 years at TBWA as well. We went over there, and that was our sort of group head promotion to actually begin to help other people with their work as well as writing our own.
And like you said, making the step up to CD, were you just called up and someone said, you know, Rainey Kelly's looking for a CD and now's the right time? Or how did that come about?
It was the same thing really as the Low Had Spink move, in that Brian and I had gone to see Mark Rolfe. We weren't happy at TBWA. I didn't particularly enjoy my 3 years there. And I was a bit disenchanted with the business. And we went over to see Mark. And he said, great, come over. You know, we'll give you a set of accounts to look after. I want you to carry on writing. Let's do it. And I thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. But Brian didn't want to do it. And so we agreed we would stick together. And that was that. And then again, Robert Campbell, Mark's creative partner, resigned and went off to McCann, I think it was. And so Mark rang me and said, look, it's a bigger job. It's the, you know, an ECD job. Would you come over and chat about doing it on your own? And I told Brian and said, look, I'm interested. And he said, yeah, gave him his blessing. And I went over and chatted to them, and they offered it to me. And I said no, actually, initially. And I went off to Australia to watch England win the World Cup and the Rugby World Cup. And then when I came back, they rang me and said, I bet you regret saying no, don't you? And I said, I haven't been able to think about anything else. And they were like, great, right. So it kind of happened. It kind of happened like that. And so, yeah, off I went on my without Brian for the first time in nearly a decade to Rainey Kelly.
And I guess when you were there, you know, that's obviously when you met your current partners. Was there any kind of view, even at that time, to eventually you wanted to start something up, or were you just getting your head down and seeing what you could do there?
Yeah, definitely not. You know, we'd been given the kind of controls to a big, successful agency. It made a lot of money. It did good work. And we were very young and inexperienced, I think, really. So we weren't thinking about anything else. We got hold of it. And it took us about 3 years to get it into a place that we were happy with. And then that's when it began, you know, clients would begin to ask questions and say, you know, surely you three are thinking about doing it. And I never wanted to. I never wanted my own business. I just thought it was a really dumb thing to do when life was so good anyway. But James and David really did. They really, really did. And the three of us loved working together, and it was a strange and still is wonderfully sort of dysfunctional, chaotic thing, but it just works. And so in the end I thought, gosh, okay, well I'll try and make this a people decision, not a business decision. I won't think about it as starting our own business. It's taken me 15 years to find these two. I don't want to take another 15 years to replace them, so let's do it. So yeah, away we went.
And were you, I mean, this is something that came up in one of the other chats I had, but the whole thing apparently that's very important is the whole chemistry thing, that you guys not only get on, but look like you get on. Were you aware of that as a very important thing yourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that you've worked together, we'd been in the trenches together for 3 years, we'd won big pitches together, and that's normally the test, actually. Sleep deprived, you know, high on junk food and too much caffeine. If you can navigate that and debate which order the charts should go in and which idea to lead with and which script or concept no one likes or loves or whatever, if you can tear the hell out of the work, really, but it not become personal or unpleasant, and we have always had tremendous ding-dongs but always about the work, that's a very difficult thing to know, that the comfort of knowing you've done it for a few years together and existed on no sleep and still come through it. And if you can win pitches, you that's the best test. Then you can go on and run a accounts and produce good work and stuff like that. Pitches is the most sort of pressurized we find ourselves, scenario we find ourselves in. So yeah, it's incredibly important. I saw a great thing once with the founders of BBH, where they basically said, well, it was perfect because we worked at TBWA and made all the stupid mistakes there. So when we did BBH, we knew what we were doing and we were up and running. We took a slightly different route, that we made stupid mistakes both at Rainy Kelly and then at Adam and Eve. Never the same one twice, but we've seemed to find an endless supply of them. But it is really important that. And I think it's a real risk if you put a team together that haven't had that experience.
Yeah, and you said that there were clients kind of suggesting it. Did that mean you thought, or you had clients that you'd be able to start up with, or was that?
No, well, no, because you know you're. I mean, it's even more so these days. But your contract is extremely watertight. There's huge lengths of time on any kind of competitive behavior and things like that. So no, it wasn't, oh great, we're going to be able to take one of these people and that'll fund the startup. It was more, we appear to be credible. No one appears to have noticed that this is the advertising equivalent of the young ones. There appears to be an appetite for us three and that we'd looked after something big enough to give us enough of a profile and enough credibility that if you give us your account, we are not going to drop it behind the sofa on day one and not be able to find it. So we didn't have a great, I don't think we were sort of rigorous in our planning particularly. We saved up some money so we could afford not to pay ourselves for the first few months. We quit. And then we all panicked and thought, "Oh my God, what have we done? You know, no one's ever gonna call." And eventually, when we launched, we started off. We borrowed some space, a meeting room in a media company, and said, "You know, can we run it out of here? We're tiny. There's nothing really going on." And they said, "Yeah." And then, sort of by accident, we won the first six pitches that we did back to back. So we were in a meeting room, someone else's meeting room, with a kind of small to medium sized agency to run, and so we went and found the world's most appalling building, a sort of terrible call centre that was kind of being knocked down while we were still in it in Covent Garden, and we also had a very unfortunate, very difficult sort of legal disagreement with Sorrell, with Martin Sorrell, and that went on for about the first 18 months of the agency. So for the first 18 months of the agency, we were a terrible creative offering. I mean, absolutely terrible. We were in kind of survival mode, and that meant, although we didn't realize it at the time, the work wasn't really the priority. The priority was pitching and winning business and gathering up business, and we did that. We did that very well, actually. We just didn't turn anything out worth talking about. And so after about 18 months, the legal situation finally resolved itself. And at that time, I persuaded the other guys to hire Ben and Emma, who I felt were the team. We definitely needed a higher caliber of kind of writing or creative in the building. And we knew we were going to get a crack at John Lewis. That was coming up, and I thought that they would be perfect for that. I didn't realise how perfect. And so we finished this legal thing. We had Ben and Emma, and then we got a run at John Lewis, and we nearly buggered that up. But we sort of threw everything in the bin with 3 days to go, and redid our whole pitch, and just didn't sleep 3 days. And we pitched, and we won that. And that was really the start of the agency. And also, what was interesting is that we then went on to make our first Christmas ad, and it wasn't the big sort of integrated super tanker that you have now. It was just a 60-second TV ad. But it was good. You know, it was a good ad. We'd finally made something good. And John Lewis liked it. And then they had their record Christmas in the company's history, and it won a gold at British Arrows. And my mum liked it. And we liked it. And that was really the start of the agency, because we suddenly thought, well, we've been involved in this awful, unpleasant, very frightening 18-month dispute. We've turned out absolutely near, and we've won a lot. That's not enough. And then we did this ad, and most people wouldn't remember it, and it's certainly It was certainly not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it was better. And it just felt so good. The feeling that, that sort of glow that it gives you, it restored everybody. It kind of, everyone was sort of bent over and it uncrinkled everyone, and this sort of warmth from this piece of work. And it was great. And then people rang up and said, hey, we really like that. Can we come in and talk to you? And so the new business kept coming, but there were people with creative ambition. They wanted to talk to us because we'd done something good. And so we from that moment on, we were like, okay, well, nothing can be worse than this. We must continue this creative journey. And so it sounds really obvious. Of course you want to be a great creative, but you can get wrapped up in all sorts of things that kind of steer you away from that. So it was a big deal that Christmas, actually. It set us on the right path.
Yeah, and just going back slightly, I don't know how much you can talk about this, but I'm someone who's been on the wrong end of an interesting legal situation with a giant company myself. And having that cloud hang over you is really kind of quite scary and debilitating. And like I said, I don't know how much you can talk about it, but was that, you know, a kind of paralyzing situation that you had on the WPP side of things, or was it something that made you more determined to kind of succeed?
I think in the middle of it, it's exactly as you describe. I mean, I don't really go into detail, and I wouldn't, and I don't think anybody connected with it would. But it was very big and very scary, and it made us, put us in a place where we weren't creatively at our best. But ultimately, it was the making of us, because we worked during the day setting up the agency, and in the evening and the weekends on the legal side of things. We worked 7 days a week, and when we finally were free of that, and we made some nice work, we thought, okay, well, we're going to work just as hard now, but just on making good stuff and winning business for clients that are creatively ambitious. So we emerged from it very tough cookies, and we worked, we continued to work at that same rate, but for the good stuff. So I think it's very difficult, and I certainly wouldn't recommend it, but ultimately it produced a really tight-knit, battle-hardened group of people who were determined to build a good agency.
And again, I don't know if you can answer this, but would it have put you off ever selling to WPP when the opportunity arose? I know you're with Omnicom, but would you never have gone to WPP because of that, or can you not say?
Well, it never happened. I think for us, Omnicom felt just like a much better fit. You know, their history and their pedigree and the sort of, we wanted to do big work for big clients that, as a happy sort of afterthought, also won awards, and we didn't want to set aside a month a year to develop supposedly sort of award-winning advertising and pump that into Cannes and whoop and high-five when that won an award while pumping out a load of old nonsense, you know, day in and day out. And we, when we met Omnicom, we realised that that's what they'd always done. They were the sort of John Webster of holding companies. They've got an amazing amount of great work in their history, but it's all big stuff. So for us, they were the obvious fit, and they came along very early on. We talked to them for an awful long time, for over a year, to make sure that it was right. And DDB had been a very, very great agency that had lost its way, and we felt we knew what it would take to fix it. It was pretty obvious and pretty simple. So it was a no-brainer for us. We never had any conversations with WPP, and we didn't need to. Omnicom was the way to go right from very early on. And as I said, we were lucky enough to be able to take time to put it together so that it was right for them and right for us. And you know, frankly, the best years the agency's ever had have been following the merger. The creatively, you know, we just carried on improving. And so all that stuff about, you know, you sell out and then that's it, you put your feet up and you're not what you were. We just got, we've been here 5 years, and it's been the best 5 years of the agency's history, and we have them to thank for that.
When you first began, I guess you had a huge amount of experience and knowledge between the three of you. Was there anything that came as a big surprise or a part of a huge learning curve in terms of starting your own place? Because, I mean, when do you have the finance guy begin? When do you employ these people? How much money can you spare to do this or that? How did that come about?
We sort of ignored all the advice that we were given. And I think it's important in a way to do that. You know, this business is not rocket science. You go with your gut instinct, go with what feels right for you and represents you as a person. We had a couple of principles that we went with. We were always pretty modest. And I mean, in terms of, you know, we were never seduced to let's get a big building or let's do this or let's do that. We were very careful and very cautious, and we always put our hands up for everything, but we made sure that we worked as hard as anyone, harder than anyone in the building. And I think, you know, you're never ready to do a startup. If it's a passion of yours, you need a little bit of profile within the business, and you need some great people. That's all you need. You need two or three people that you kind of go to all for and go to all with. I'm a great believer that most people in this business are totally winging it. Most of the agencies that you look at, most of the pontificating that we have to read in campaign, you know, that most people in our business seem to spend their lives telling the rest of us what's wrong with the business and how we should be doing the business. But then when you look at what they actually produce day in and day out, you think, why am I listening to these people? So we went in and got everything wrong once, and the only thing, you know, and then didn't repeat it. And we were very Spartan, and we just worked really hard and absolutely went for it. But you absolutely have to have a chemistry between you, and clients would play that back the whole time, that they'd been to see bigger agencies and it just felt like another meeting, and they came to us and we were bouncing off each other and sparking off each other, but also they could tell that it was life or death to us, that we really wanted the account. You need, I was very lucky, James and David are both financially very, very good, so we initially need anybody in the finance function, and then we got someone, but just cut your cloth modestly and it's incredibly exciting, and you just remember that no one knows what they're doing. Everyone's making it up. And so why shouldn't your made-up version work, and why shouldn't it be great? And ultimately, you do work that's a reflection of yourself. Don't try and be somebody that you're not. As I said, we wanted to do big, famous work. We never pitched for small little things. The first pitch we ever did was for the Telegraph. And that was it. And the tradition was that startups did lots of small stuff for friends and charities, and that's how they got known. And then we didn't want to do that. We wanted to do, you know, we wanted to be big in the chiller cabinet or in the newsagents or, you know, like Webster, like the stuff that that was the stuff I noticed when I was a kid. And that's really because that's where we believe the magic is, and that's what we wanted to do, and that was a reflection of us.
How did you
didn't answer your question. I can't remember what your question was. I'll sort of ramble around there. So.
I don't remember it either, but it doesn't matter. But it was a good answer. How did you get onto those pitch lists then at the very beginning? Because I know when you're starting, it takes the ratio of work to output is much, much higher, because, you know, you really have to move heaven and earth to even get someone to listen to you. And people go, well, your agency hasn't really done very much so far, so why would I? So how did you get on those big pitch lists initially?
Well, that's what I mean about a bit of profile. You know, you ultimately, James was very well known to new business consultants and to campaign. And we'd done a bit of stuff, David and I, with campaign. But David and I are not big, we're not great networkers or schmoozers at all. And generally sort of stand at the back of a do, looking awkward and wondering when we can scuttle away to the pub. But James is very good at that, and so you do need a bit of profile. You want people to put you on lists, and to be honest, any pitch list, if it's got a good new business consultant, should be like a director's. The way I approach director, you know, where you don't go, right, we'll get three enormous global director, and they can all pitch again. I'm always like, here are two big heavyweights. Here's someone I've had my eye on for a while. They haven't really got the work to justify being on this list, but they are going to be great. I know they're going to be great. And then here's a film that I've been watching incessantly for the last 3 weeks, and they're kind of mid. You try and build a blend in your list. Otherwise, you're effectively going on 4 blind dates with the same girl. It's kind of dumb. So if there's a pitch, we would always be, oh, and those idiots who just started that thing with the funny name. You know, why not? So we'll have M&C Saatchi, we'll have Blah, Abbott Mead, and then we'll have those guys. And of course, then that's your moment. You sell yourself on the fact that I remember when we pitched for Fosters, and the client said to me, "We've only ever seen M&C's creative director once." And when I say seen, I mean we looked out of our meeting room, and he was walking by on a way to another meeting. Whereas I know you're going to be my copywriter, David's going to be my planner, and James is going to be my account exec. And I know I can ring you at midnight on Sunday and you'll pick up. And that's why we're here. And so that's what you sell. You sell, this is life and death to us. It's not just another pitch. This is the most important. I mean, the amount of times James said in a year, this is the most important meeting we'll do this year. But that's your USP, and it's a great thing to have, because you are an outsider, and I think because I started as an account person, I've always felt like an outsider in the business. I never really feel like born to do it and he belongs. You know, but it's very useful, that feeling. It's very useful. It's like being a challenger man, and it gives you something to kick against. It gives you a healthy disregard and disrespect for what's supposed to be the norm and all the shit that people talk. And that situation when you're a startup is very powerful, and you point out the sort of scale and laziness of the big guys, and yeah. you're hungry and you'll go further and they'll get a lot more for their money.
Yeah, I find that it's almost weird that people don't go with startups more, because, yeah, you are getting the creative director as your copywriter and the account guy.
Yeah.
And so that seems enormously, you know, why
it's
not?
Like, it's like all these people who spend all of this time trying to come up with a sort of point of view for a new agency. You know, that it was one of the things we decided very early on we weren't going to do. We weren't going to do those set of charts, which is we bring you the... everyone takes their clothes off and paints themselves blue, and we charm, and then out comes the big idea. This is the process that we're going to bring to you. We just thought it's a simple business. It ultimately, startups give you access to the sort of people that would be kept from you in a big agency. You get to do every meeting with every John Lewis meeting would be me, James, and David, and a fabulous growing team. But you know, we had Ben and Emma or Tammy and people like that, but. That's what we did for years and years and years, and they're all still here. We're all still here, and Craig and John Lewis is still there. And that's what it gives you. So every year when startups launch, you get, you know, we're about this, we're about that. But ultimately, the big selling point is great access to the very best talent and better creative.
Yeah, I often wonder about the gimmicky thing, because it feels like some people feel like you've got to do something to stand out. Because there was someone I spoke to who said, why, if you were a client, why wouldn't you give your work to your account to, say, someone like AMV or whatever? Because you know it's going to be well looked after, and you know something good's going to happen. But I think that whole kind of question of what you supposedly stand for. There's an agency that's just started here. I'm sorry if any of you are listening, because I don't mean this in a negative way, but I think they're called the Fortnite Collective, because their thing is they will do your work in 2 weeks. And I thought, that's an interesting thing. But then at the bottom of the explanation, it goes, some clients might need more than 2 weeks, in which case, you know, we'll do it a bit longer than that. And I thought,
we're the Fortnite Collective. As long as that works for you, in which case we can be something else.
Yeah, that's their whole name now. It's going to be as long as Simon's Palmer back in those days. Anyway, so, yeah, it's funny that the gimmick thing seems to be so important to people, just so that they've got something to say. But you're absolutely right. I think when it comes down to it, ad agencies are ad agencies, and if you've got the good people.
Well, also, remember the process. So don't write your agency document in isolation of the process. The process is that the client will come to you at 1:30, having been to 2 or 3 other agencies in the morning. And if every one of those agencies, after they do their welcome, clicks through 10 charts, which explain the only way to create fabulous creative work and effective advertising is we believe in, you know, one idea indivisible. By the time you get to the third agency, you just go, you realise it's nonsense. And also, it gives you a point of view, which is when you buy a car, you're looking at the car, aren't you? You're not like, tell me the family history of the guy who painted it, or so our big thing was always, you're very encouraged early on to be different. And in the end, it was like, why don't we just try and be good? And so rather than saying, here's what we believe in, we'll go, here's what we did for this client, and then something totally different, here's what we did for this client, and then something completely different, here's what we did for this client. We'd love to do something for you. And let your work be the evidence of your principles, rather than a load of sort of rather bloated, pompous charts. I think, as I said, the reason that startups work is Droga 5, I'm sure, was a great success because people wanted to go and see Dave Droga, yeah, and the gang there and be in on that at the ground floor. These guys have got big agency experience. They know how to look after big clients and big brands. But we could be their third client. How much love and attention will we get rather than just being another client somewhere else? So that's the way it is. That's where it's always been. You know, you can go very light on the waffly charts, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Going back to the hiring of Ben and Emma, I think it's interesting because that's the only other time you and I met, when Daryl and I came in.
That's
Is the office you're talking about the one that was above Stringfellows? Because I think that's where we put. Yes. It's very convenient for it being above Stringfellows, I guess, for lunchtimes and stuff. But I'd say, just to preface this, you 1,000,000% made the right decision to hire Ben and Emma and not me and Daryl. But I wondered exactly, you know, what the process was there and why Ben and Emma were the team, because you got that so right. Was there something you saw in them beyond their really good work? And the fact that, you know, I know them both really well, and I think they're lovely people too. So what exactly was the thing that made you get those guys, or feel like they were the ones you were going to make the gamble on that quite large salary or whatever you...
Yeah. I mean, it was a gamble. We couldn't afford them. And we hired them, and we didn't really have any way to pay them long term. And we just thought, well, it'll work. Hopefully it'll work. So it was a huge gamble for them in particular, but they didn't know that. I'd always really liked them as a combination. I'd liked Emma's this amazing kind of, she can illustrate, she can write headlines, she can art direct, she's gone on to write books and do all sorts of fabulous creative, beautiful illustrations, stuff like that. And Ben's a fabulous writer and a sort of incredible ad geek, can tell you every credit on every piece of work going back, which I love. And I used to try and compete with him, but he's definitely out-muscling me these days. And I felt that we would be really good for each other. So I felt that we needed just a team that had the kind of pure creativity that they had, and I felt that's definitely what we needed, and we were going to need that more and more with the sort of clients that were calling us up. And I felt that they could do with having their kind of top buttons undone a bit. You know, they were at DDB. It was quite old school. It was all quite sort of slow and sensible and neat. And actually, clients more and more at that point were like, let's get in a room. Let's, you know, kick it about. Blah blah blah. And so we dragged them into a culture of discussing ideas being kicked about, ideas being improved, grown, and just said to them, look, there's a variety of process here. You know, sometimes a creative team disappear for 2 weeks and come back with the answer, hurrah. Sometimes we get a load of different creatives all in a room and we do that. I would sometimes write work with David because I really enjoyed that. And he was always very good with ideas, but not necessarily with execution. And we tried to just mix up the way we produced work as much as possible, and not to dismiss any of those ways of doing it, but not to become addicted to one. So I just felt we'd become a better agency with them, and they would become a better team through us, and we both needed what the other had, and that's exactly what happened. And it was perfect, and we both nicked the good bits from each other and came out out the other side as a really strong unit. And it, funnily enough, it came down to them and Rick and Dan, and we went with Ben and Emma, and then eventually Rick and Dan were our first big hiring on the merger with DDB, and went on to, yeah, I mean, I think they won 4 Grand Prix in Cannes for their first year here. So yeah, it was great. Ben and Emma remain a very important part of the family.
There was a point where I went to a Q&A with the guy who directed Gravity, and he'd spent the entire previous hour telling us what an incredible labor of love, and how he used so many new techniques that no one knew it was going to work. And I thought, well, this is incredible because it took lots of money and won lots of Oscars and all this kind of stuff. And I said to him, so now that it's been so successful, do you feel like, you know, it's, you know, even bigger success because of what you went through and the uncertainty at the beginning? And he said, no, it wasn't really happiness, it was more relief. And I thought that was a really interesting answer, which leads me to ask you, I guess when you start your agency up, I mean, are your wildest dreams even to become what you've actually become? Because I think Adam and Eve is what people look at, not just in the UK, but around the world, as one of the best agencies of this time. Did you think you'd end up at this point? And how does it feel?
No. And it feels like it's all happened to someone else. So you sit there. I remember when we won. Where were we? We were in Cannes and we won 4 Grand Prix, and then we won Agency of the Year at Cannes. And sitting there, surrounded by all these huge gongs. And me and James and David and Rick and Dan, and it's just, everyone's just sitting in total silence, just sort of, you know, you just couldn't believe it. And I think it's very important not to, because otherwise those sorts of things. We're very good at having an hour of this feels great, and then you just come in the next day and get on with the next thing. And I think that's important. But I mean, I remember after we did our first John Lewis Christmas ad, we then went on the next ad. It was an ad with Dougal, Always a Woman. And I remember when we were working on that, and our only thought was, please don't let it be worse than the Christmas ad we just made. That was the sort of, and we've often been like that. No one ever sat down and said, and then we'll conquer the world. And the weird thing is that when those things come near and you think, well, I think we're going to be Agency of the Year this year, and you think and you hope and you can't sleep and stuff like that. And then when you get it, I mean, I'm sure there's a reason why we all use these football analogies and expressions, but like Ferguson used to say, you know, you win the Premier League and it's lovely for an hour or two, and then your brain turns to, I wonder if we could do it next year or something like that. So I think it's important, that kind of mindset is important. We definitely have that. We're not a great celebration agency, I don't think. We do a bit of it, but no, we never sat down at the start and said, let's be this and let's be that. And that's where we just tried to be the best that we as a group could be. And we didn't really know where the limit was on that. And it kept shifting. So we kept marching forward.
There's one other question I wanted to ask about the whole beginning of it. And that's why Adam and Eve? And was it difficult to come up with?
Well, this is a cause of much dispute amongst founding partners. I'll tell you the truth, and then if you ever get to interview the others, you can yell liar the moment they start. No, it's actually, we, like a lot of the things at Adam and Eve, it came out of a very lovely but extremely poorly thought through idea, which was one of the things we were going to do was we weren't going to hire creative teams. We were going to hire creative individuals from PR, advertising, events. In those days, there were still, you know, digital and non-digital and just have a series, a collection of individuals. And then when a brief would come in, we were going to look at the problem and go, I tell you, it'd be interesting to pair them with them and get them to work on it. So we're like, okay, that's a great idea. And of course, what happened was then we drew up a list of the creative people we wanted to talk to, and they were all in teams, and none of them wanted to move without their partner. So we abandoned that principle almost immediately. But it led to Adam and Eve. We had 85... 90 names. One of them was Adam and Eve. It was the only one that we all liked and all of our wives liked. James was excited because as an account person, he thought it was fabulous that we'd be very early on alphabetically. So whatever archaic new business book people used to turn to, there we would be close to Abbot Mead. But it just, to me, you can overstress these things. We ran around the houses, and then we all picked that one. The most important thing for us, that it wasn't our surnames. You know, we wanted to move away from that kind of country solicitor vibe and to something else. And so, yeah. And I think Tim Lindsay, I was chatting with Tim Lindsay at DNAZ, and he said quite rightly, ultimately, a name is irrelevant. It's what you fill it up with that gives it its meaning. And that's true. But for us, the most important thing is it's not going to be called Murphy Golding Priest.
Right. Well, I mean, I think at that time, the three names structure, it was certainly dying on its arse in some way. I mean, Mother kind of blew that up enormously.
Yeah.
Now you've got to call yourself, you know, green banana or whatever. Well, I don't know,
but yeah, carbuncle. Yeah,
carbuncle.
It'll come. Listen, in 10 years' time, people will be only naming their names after the three partners' surnames. It'll be a bizarre U-turn. But yeah, it was very important that. And Mother was the agencies we were really looking at were BBH, just because they just kept doing it and they kept having a new set of management and still turning out good work. And they always did work that the public noticed as much as the jury did. And we loved them for that. They were as good as anyone creatively, but they were in the middle of kind of real work. And Mother were the same. You know, Robert and the guys came along and they changed the business. And so those were the two agencies we looked at. We went to talk to lots of agencies and picked their brains, but those were the two agencies we really looked at enviously. And BBH was certainly, when we were starting our first 3 years, I think we were campaign agency of the year in our third year. But the 3 years before that, it had been BBH back to back to back.
Oh, yeah. And
it was great. It was great to know you weren't as good as the best, and you could be really honest about that. We knew where we had to get to. We were trying to catch them. I think it's very important that. It's very important. The thing that will kill your startup, you have to have a group of people where you're not looking after an ego. You have to have a group of people who are going to pull together, and you can be really brutal about the work, but you're not having to take care of one person's ego. And you also have to be brutally honest about where you are. How are we third? Are we fifth? Where are we? And where are we trying to get to? And BBH really helped us because they were just head and shoulders above everybody else, us included. So we kept aiming there.
Right. The other thing I was going to ask is, there's a lot of sort of management books about how to run companies and things like that. And I think when you're in the weeds of it, I'm not saying that stuff goes out the window, but every situation in every company is its own unique set of circumstances. So how have you found the, I guess, progression of, you know, you go from a startup, but now you're in charge of this giant agency that's doing amazing work all over the place. How have things changed in terms of how you manage it as a company?
I mean, we were never really interested in running a company. We, James, David and myself, really would like to be the three of us in a room with a client trying to crack a problem and do something good. And actually, the people who run the company, we're lucky we have lots of people here who do a very good job of running the company. But when you're a startup, you don't need to worry about that. The culture is set. You're all sitting around one table, and it's set by the personalities around that table, and you're just going at ramming speed. You don't need to clutter yourself up. James, David and I never do any training, never go on any of that sort of stuff. It's a simple business, this. You know, don't make it complicated. It's a group of people coming together to have some fun, work seriously hard, and produce great stuff at the end of it, and look after your clients along the way. And when we arrived here, yeah, it was much bigger, and we spent about 18 months doing a lot of kind of HR meetings and people leaving and people being asked to leave and that sort of stuff, which is very difficult. But I mean, ultimately, the first thing we did was we just said, right, we're going to get rid of all the offices. We're going to get rid of all the departments. We're not going to sit on five floors. We're going to sit on two big open plan office, floors all mixed in. And we're going to become a group. We're going to become a company. We're not going to exist in separate silos. And we're all going to get to know each other. We're all going to understand what everyone's worrying about and working on and begin to appreciate each other. And then we're going to get a sense of the company as a whole, and we're going to look after the company as a whole. And we're going to create a feeling of togetherness. And everyone's going to have a voice. Everyone's going to be able to get to the microphone. We're not going to have big, fat, lazy people sectioned off in offices here, there, and everywhere. And you do that, and then if you've got a few retail accounts, you've got day-to-day business, bustle, activity, and the tempo goes up. And we always like to be busy, and we like to work quickly, sometimes less than a fortnight. I hate to be the bearer of bad news to people out there. And that was it. And along the way, we developed some informal things. When we used to recruit people, we'd say, we'll give you the best years of your career. Everyone who works here has had the best years of their career here. And that's what it'll be. It'll be the most fun. It'll be the most rewarding. And it'll be very personal. It won't be an agency. This will become your company. You'll influence it, you'll shape it, and you'll move it. And it will feel very, very personal, even if you're not a founding partner. And you lead by example. And so I've never been on any kind of training. I've never indulged in any of that. But good booze up at Christmas, get people great briefs, support and defend their work to the death. And they know that you're there for them. And don't have an open door, because you don't have a door. People can come and talk to you and see you about anything, and make sure people make great work. You know, it's not complicated. I think we make it complicated, and it can be complicated if that's what you want, but it definitely doesn't need to be.
And in that sort of, I mean, I guess it's a slightly unusual thing that maybe happened to Rainey Kelly when it joined Y&R, but in that sort of almost like reverse takeover, that the slightly smaller entity is, I don't know, becoming in charge of DDB. Was there friction involved in that part of the process?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think, listen, it, again, you make yourself very unpopular talking about this. You don't, I do. But
you don't have
DDB,
to,
so. DDB, no, I don't mind at all. It's important, DDB, because it's about honesty, I think, as well.
Yeah.
That's one thing we had as an agency. We were very honest with each other. We didn't present things, we didn't do things if they weren't good enough. And you didn't have to pretend that they were good enough because someone senior had done them or someone important had liked them. It's very brutal like that. It just does it make the boat go faster? Is it going to make the work better? Well, then we'll do it. And if not, no. And DDB had been an extremely good agency. I mean, a great agency. And BNP DDB had been a phenomenal agency.
Mm.
But that was a long time ago. And when we got here, it was an agency that was really in the shadows. They laid off, you know, I think they've had to lay off 100 people the year before we merged. But when you got here, the attitude was, who the fuck are you? We're fucking brilliant. You're like, well, not really. You know, how are we going to do a wake-up call here? So I said, well, let's make everyone go open plan. And it's the most physically brutal piece of evidence that this is going to change. And it's the thing that will upset the most people. And that's what this place needs. It needs a wake-up call. And, of course, we inherited some amazing accounts. We discovered all sorts of fabulous people here. But a lot of people didn't like it, and that was fine with us. And but I hope that we've put it back where it belongs. You know, I hope we've been very lucky to have a small time at the controls, that John Webster was at the controls that Martin Bowes was at. You know, some incredible, incredible people. If you think of that department with Richard Nandy and Nick Gill and Kim and Tony and Paul Burke and,
yeah,
you know, Frank Budgeon, and absolutely incredible. And anyone who thinks that I don't love that, and I didn't love that, and I wasn't enormous about that, is mad. But what I found when I got here wasn't that, and I wasn't going to pretend that it was. So you just have to cut through all of that crap and go, if you want to be great again, this is how we're going to do it. And if you don't, then, you know, here's Liz Harrell's phone number, and that's that. And it was very difficult. It's very difficult. The people here were very frightened. They didn't want anything to change. They were sort of going, but we must do it this way. We've always done it this way. And I think it had been very difficult for them. There'd been a lot of senior changes, and it hadn't been great. So you can understand why they were like that. But our point of view was, again, a bit like Ben and Emma. Let's take the best bits of DDB and the best bits of Adam and Eve and combine them to make an agency that's better than both of the agencies that both of those agencies. And I hope that's what we've done. I'm a massive fan of the only ads I have in my house are old black and white VW print ads, and the only advertising book I have is the book about the Abbott Marc Antonio.
Yeah. Remember the great VW ads.
Yeah, maybe remember those great VW ads. And I love all that, but what I'm not going to do is come into somewhere that used to be great and do it the disservice of pretending that it still is and just watch it wither. And it seemed that people were prepared to do that. So we said, no, we're not prepared to do that. We're going to do some very difficult things to reboot it.
I'm also wondering how you always featured in the press, because I don't really... Maybe, I don't know if I was reading everything at the time or it was always that conscious for me, but did you feel a sort of groundswell of positivity from Campaign and places like that, you know, in terms of the progress you're making?
I don't... It's funny that. It was never a conscious thing. I mean, we met... I remember James coming back from somewhere once and saying, God, I've just met someone who said, so... You know, do you still have the three PR people? And he was like, what do you mean? So we know, everyone knows that you had three PR people permanently working on the, you know, which was hilarious because it was James calling Campaign incessantly. but I think to an extent, there's no doubt that the advertising press love a startup because what they want is they want a vibrant business in which the landscape's constantly evolving. That makes for interesting and good copy and for an interesting and good business. So, yeah, quite rightly, I think that they do support. But only for a while, and after that, you've got to start doing it. And we had this amazing new business run, and then we finally sorted out creatively. We finally got our heads stuck into creative. So I don't know, but it certainly wasn't planned or orchestrated. It was just a combination of people wishing us well at the start and then us taking advantage of our start.
Right. The other thing I was just going to ask you about, and I think I mentioned this when I spoke to Emma, it's really fascinating how John Lewis became this weird English version of the Super Bowl, because I'm not kidding. It got mentioned over here in my agency several times, like, well, you know, it's that Christmas time. What are the Christmas ads coming out in England right now? Do you feel like it's been a good thing or a bad thing? Because the industry has effectively copied the John Lewis slightly emotional 60-second model so tightly that it's kind of created a genre of its own. And in some ways, the repetition of that's not great. But in other ways, it's created some really good ads.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we don't have any control over it, I think is the honest answer. We certainly never set out to do it. We just started writing the sort of work that we felt was right for them. I think it is a bit weird that, I mean, certainly the level of devotion to the John Lewis ad can feel a bit odd at times. I get people contacting me in sort of July saying, who I don't know, saying, when is it coming out? What is it? You know, I get mums and dads at the school gates who I don't know coming up to me going, I hated that music, or I love that, this, or, you know, stuff like that. But at the same time, it's a high class problem. I love the fact that millions and millions of people watch them and like them. I just think it's sort of created a bit of a weird competition at Christmas. And it seems to be, my worry, I guess, is that it's a lot of brands competing for what an agency would say is the best ad rather than necessarily doing the right thing by their client. I mean, John Lewis doesn't compete with the majority of advertisers who are making great big 2-minute epics. So it's weird. But I think I'm incredibly proud of John Lewis. I love the fact that that people have noticed something that we've done and people seem to have liked it. I get a lot of stick from friends who are creative saying, if I go to another meeting where someone says the client wants a John Lewis, I'm going to come down to Paddington and whack you over the head with a hammer. So, you know, apologies to people for that. But yeah, it's been a happy accident. We were normally just, as I said, saying, God, I hope this one isn't worse than the last one we did.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I think we've covered most things. I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on, but I think that's been a pretty comprehensive look at.
No, I mean, I think it's starting up is a. I normally say, you know, I don't normally do lots of interviews or articles or stuff like that, but it was you, and B, starting up, I think, is an interesting thing to talk about. And we were desperate for a long time for there to be a great startup, because we were always on each pitch list as the sort of funny outsider, and it became exhausting. We were like, can't someone else come? We can't say no to these things and burn our bridges with these people. But it would be really nice if someone, but I do think it is the most fun you can have in advertising, and it's great to have an agency that is yours and is a reflection of the values you have and the personality that you have. But I think my main piece of advice would be ignore 99% of the advice and shit that gets thrown at you, and go for it. Everyone's winging it. If you're going to do it, why not do it on your own behalf with some friends? And it's a lot of fun.
Great. Well, I think that's a fantastic note to end on. And huge thanks again for your time, Ben.
Not at all, Ben. It's lovely to talk to you. And you know where we are in Paddington. If you make it back over here for a holiday, come and see us. I can promise you a warm cup of tea or an underwhelming pub within a 5-minute walk from here.
Oh, yeah, I know that one. Okay, great. Well, yeah, I may pop in. Thank you very thank you very much, Ben.
Okay, lovely to talk to you.
You too.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.
This is a podcast to watch Christmas.